Welcome to the 15th episode of Three Cartoon Avatars. So I say 15th episode of Three Cartoon Avatars. This will be the last episode of Three Cartoon Avatars. We are shifting the name and the brand and all that stuff to just Cartoon Avatars. So what you're going to hear is this is by far our longest single episode. And so we're going to break it into a few different parts. And so one, you're going to hear a conversation at the top with Zach and I talking about he's actually going to take a step back from the podcast and I'll let him explain it. The Machiavellian backstabbing that I did to Zach. We'll talk through all of that. And then second, you're going to hear a conversation with Praying for Exits from Instagram, in which we hit a bunch of different topics that were going on in the tech world this week. Then you'll hear a really interesting conversation about Bored Ape Yacht Club in general, where NFTs are, all of that stuff, with three special guests that I had on, a guy by the name of Tropo Farmer, who's on Twitter, as well as Alex, who is a big Bored Ape Yacht Club or a big holder of Bored Apes, as well as a CEO of Upstream, which is building infrastructure for DAOs. And then Mags, who is a consumer venture investor, but also a holder of Bored Ape Yacht Club. And so we sort of go into all the details of what's happening there. And then finally, you'll hear a conversation that we recorded earlier this week between Packy McCormick and Ben Thompson. We go through a bunch of different stuff about how they think about building their brand and their newsletters, podcasts, all of that stuff. The two of them actually had never spoken. They're kind of existing on outer ends of the ecosystem. One focused on subscription and paid, kind of Ben Thompson, the OG in this world, and then Packy as kind of a newer entrant and focused on advertising. And so that was a really fun conversation. So hopefully you're excited to have a lot of different listening here and bearing with us as we go through this evolution, where it's going to be mostly me and having a host of friends on as well. I have a special guest next week that I think will be really exciting to kind of talk through all of this stuff. And so, excited for you to hear everything we have. So next up, you'll hear me and Zach talking about his official firing from the podcast.
I think people have known we've now done, Logan's done, 14 of these so far? And I've done 13 of these so far. Obviously, it's been a lot of fun, but the truth is that as we've done more and more of these, there are topics that, are harder for me to comment on given the seat that I'm in. And so ultimately, while I love being a part of the podcast and I have a ton of fun doing it every week, it probably makes sense for me to take a step back either into part-time or contributing on the topics that are the most accessible to me, given the seat that I'm in. And so going forward, I'm excited that you'll hear a lot of other voices from folks who can comment on a wide range of topics. And when I'm able to, I'll be back certainly for the things that are in my wheelhouse, and hopefully I can be a little funny, a little smart on, and also, I'm more able to comment on freely too.
Yeah, no, Zach, that's a great way of saying I stabbed you in the back, and this is a whole
Logan coup.
Exactly. This is a great way of articulating the coup. But I appreciate you putting some window dressing on it. It's been a lot of fun, and obviously there's been different constraints. I think this makes the most sense. I'm bummed because it's been so much fun doing this with you, and now I'm sort of out on an island a little bit with Nikita doing part time, you doing part time. It's good. I mean, we're going to keep doing it. We'll keep having people on. There'll definitely be opportunities for people that are far more qualified than you and me and Nikita to come on and weigh in on subjects. Not
anyone who's more qualified than the three of us.
But I know. Career investors just weighing in on topics in general. Yeah, I believe it or not, there are people that actually have more expertise than the two of us, certainly. But obviously, thanks for doing this and bearing with all the different machinations we've gone through, and look forward to, obviously, we're still going to talk every day or whatever, every other day in some form. I'm excited to still have you around and certainly input in all this and coming on as different situations present themselves.
Then I'll be a weekly listener. This is the only podcast I will ever consistently listen to. Now,
the best podcast.
The best podcast ever created in history, probably ever.
Well, I am joined today by everyone's favorite Instagram account associated with the tech and VC world, a pseudonymous venture investor. You might know him as Praying for Exits on Instagram. And so happy to have him on the podcast. Thanks for joining me today, Mr. Exits.
And thank you for having me. Shout out to you and the rest of the Redpoint family. Appreciate you having me.
Appreciate you doing this, and hopefully this goes well, and we can make this a regular thing. So for people that don't know your account, which I can't imagine too many of those are listening, but maybe give us a quick primer background on yourself, how the account started, and I guess in full disclosure, I actually we've never met that I know, and so I you've told me there's nothing cancelable in your past that's going to come back to haunt me at some point.
Not yet, anyway.
Yeah, not yet. So I am acting in good faith on that one, but maybe level set on just how you started the account, who you are, all that stuff.
Yeah, so I've been investing in the venture space for probably the last, I want to say, 7 or 8 years. And when I was, I started this page in 2018, so it's been about 4 years now. So about 4 or 5 years ago, I was basically at the point where I think a lot of people in venture get to, which is they start to, the sort of patina of how cool it is maybe begins to wear off a little bit, and you get to see kind of the underbelly for all its glory. And so I think I was at a point in my life where I kind of started it as a sort of a journal for myself and just experiencing different things in the venture ecosystem. And back then it was like a really sort of wild time. It was sort of the height of like the WeWorks and the Ubers and Airbnbs and that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of like really good and interesting material that was coming out all the time. And
it's like people keep making documentaries or whatever, like shows about all that stuff. So
yeah. So yeah, like right now we're starting to see more sophisticated version of content about that time period come out. But at the time, there was nobody who really, that I felt was giving sort of like an honest shake about what was really going on. And I don't know about how many people who are listening were active in the space back then, but it was a very much so, it was a different experience in the sense that there was a lot more sort of puff pieces and people just kind of like creating narratives that were just maybe the best versions of those narratives, not the most honest ones. And to me, that kind of just sat the wrong way. And I was actually really inspired a little bit before by what I saw with like Arab Spring and stuff. Not that this has like any overlap at all, but in the sense that it was really surprising to me how much ideas could be pushed through content. And it doesn't really matter. It didn't really matter at the time who in Arab Spring was spreading these ideas. Just the fact that it reached a velocity where the ideas were so strong that they spoke for themselves. And in sort of a miniature way, I kind of wanted to maybe use that as a framework to bring more honesty and a little bit more clarity to what was actually going on. And so, yeah, it's a long-winded way of saying I run a meme page.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you polish it up very nicely. So what was the decision to be pseudonymous in, did it just give you the ability to talk more freely about what you were thinking and not risk backlash? Like, how did you think through that?
Initially, it was just because in my own regular life, I'm like a very private person. I don't really like a lot of attention. But over time, I realized that the power was there's a lot of power in letting ideas speak. And I think that venture is one of those places where we've been blinded a little bit by who people are and maybe what they've accomplished in the past. And we don't very often... we're doing it a lot more now, but in the past, people weren't really standing on ideas. They were kind of just standing on personas. And I thought that the best way for you to stand on your ideas is to not have anything associative with you. And so, yeah, that was kind of the start of it all.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Well, doing this with you today, I think finally proves once and for all that I've been accused a number of times of being running your account. And I've always said, like, you see what I post normally. Why do you think like I'm holding some stuff back? But it is interesting. I mean, the perspective that you have and the jokes that you're able to make, especially going through that, like, hype cycle that we've had over the course of the last, 12 years in some ways, 2 years in others. It definitely was able to poke at some of the self-seriousness that I think exists in the industry. And so I think it's been a refreshing view on, you know, some of the things that we're all thinking but can't actually say. And so it's definitely appreciated from that perspective. And I do think, I mean, at the end of the day, I don't feel like you're coming from a malicious place on this stuff, right? Like you're never really punching down at people that don't deserve it. I know you've at times people have had beef with you, but I feel like it's always fair, right? You've made jokes at our expense, my expense, but it was all like well-meaning, I never took actually offense to it. It's like, if you're going to be out there in public doing stuff, like you got to be willing to roll with the punches, right?
Yeah. And to that point, I think that the person that I make fun of the most, if people actually knew who I was, is myself. Like half of the shit that I'm talking about is shit that happens to me or is directly affecting me in some way, shape or form.
I didn't. So you are Philippe Lafont. So you run Coto. Got it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If Philippe could just hand over the keys to the house, that'd be nice.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
but yeah, I mean, I think that, there's a real benefit, to approaching it in that way. And, I think that like, if you're not willing to be criticized, then there's something wrong with you as a person, because nobody's above it. And I especially believe that of myself. And so, I think that if you're living in like, this fragmented reality where you're kind of like just picking and choosing what you want to believe is real, and you're only focused on the best versions of everything, then you're probably not a very good investor, because that's not a characteristic that works really well in any market. So,
yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I sort of attribute the 2000 late 2000s of blogging was kind of the first, I feel like, foray. And you know, Cal Canis obviously did it. Fred Wilson did it. Mark Suster, my partner Tomas, was big and pretty early on it. And
my favorite legend.
Yeah, it started to peel back the onion a little bit on some of these things, but it's, you know, I think it's good that people are showing more elements of their personality. Right now, I think what we found is a lot of venture capitalists are particularly funny, right? But at least they're trying to, you know, show a more holistic view and not just be polished and sort of silver spooned and everything's perfect at all times, right? They're trying to be more relatable to entrepreneurs. I think that's healthy.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, just like being a normal human being, there's nothing wrong with that. Like to be somebody who like embraces the duality of your personality, the good and the bad, it's like the most honest thing that you can do. And the founders that I've worked with that have been the most successful are people who genuinely do that. Like if you're just ignoring all the bad shit and you are, like permanently focused on these shreds of good that you're doing without really diving in deep, it's like that's a problem that translates into a whole host of other issues as things go down the line. So I think it's really important that people, like, nobody is too important in this industry to not have some level of accountability. And, you know, I think it's just important that we all remember that, because it's easy to forget.
You don't have self-doubt or like crippling self-doubt, but you do want to have self-awareness, right? Mm-hmm. About like where your shortcomings are. And everything is a double-edged sword, right? There is to be extroverted means that you're probably not as perceptive of like different things, because you're out there, you know, not watching, you're talking more often. Or like to be analytical means you're not going to be as intuitive or whatever. Like all these things kind of have another side of the coin. And so if you're not aware of your shortcomings, I feel like I came up in venture and I kind of had two mentors, and they had such gravitas when they spoke, and they were so measured in their words because they had so many successes over the course of their career. Neeraj Agarwal was my mentor at Battery Ventures, and then Rob Ward is at Meritech, and just an absolutely incredible investor, incredible person. And they had such heft and experience that they could draw on. And I just kind of realized I couldn't do that, right? Like I am never going to be, or it's going to take me another 15, 20 years of investing before I have like my words, just I can silence the room, and I can be the one that carries, you know, and draws on the past drawdown that happened or the past correction, right? I just can't do that. And so I had to find like a different way that I related to entrepreneurs, a different way that I added value. And so, yeah, I mean, I feel like we're in this world of hyper-personalization of the products that people offer to entrepreneurs. And I think that's a good thing, right? The power balance has shifted from VCs to all the way to entrepreneurs. And now we're like coming back a little bit to VCs, but it's healthy, right?
Yeah, I think that one thing that it seems like people forget is like, obviously this is a business and everything should be business oriented in some way, shape or form. But at the end of the day, this is also like life, and life is very multifaceted. And to like really get the most out of life and business and all of the other things that are really important to people in their time here, I think that you have to have a much broader spectrum of understanding that isn't, you know, just limited to like one specific thing that you can offer founders in this day and age. Like if you're just the guy who can figure out how to increase or decrease customer acquisition cost, and that's your secret sauce, I'm sure that's useful. But the guy who can kind of do that, but also just be like a normal, interesting person to work with, is gonna get an equal chance to fight for an allocation or whatever it might be. So I think that, yeah, just like the humanization of the industry is something that I'm so fucking here for, because it was whack when we were all just robots. So
I'm sure it's nice for you as well. For me, like I to some extent, I feel like Elon Musk has justified, it's kind of papered over any of the questions that people would have had about like, wait, why are you doing this? Or, and now Mark Andreessen's doing it far more. And like some of these just amazingly successful people are pushing the envelope of, joking online and not taking themselves too seriously. And I think, that's given me a nice halo and bubble. It's like, well, that guy's the richest person in the world. And that guy's like, invented the web browser and built one of the most iconic like venture firms. Right. And so I think I get a little bit of leeway if I'm going to joke around. Right. It is nice to have some of these archetypes pop up. That's not just me out there or you out there, doing these things. It seemed kind of silly. I mean, this started. All these things kind of started as a joke, and now I don't know. I mean, there's resonance with it, right? And I'm sure it's benefited you in a bunch of different ways.
I think if you look at history in general, the power of jokes is actually pretty understated, and the place that it exists within culture and society is very influential in a lot of ways. You can look at political cartoons. You can look at the advent of the sitcom, and there's a variety of like. The great part about comedy in general is because it actually speaks truths. And I think that people are seeking truth more than ever in this day and age, because there's very clear paradigms in which they've been lied to from a whole host of different people. And so I think that if you are A, using comedy, but B, really what you're doing is seeking a level of truth and being more transparent or more honest in a type of way, at the end of the day, that magnetizes people and that brings people closer to you, because I think real is the being real is the highest form of capital in this kind of market, right? Because you don't want the person that you are worried about, like, oh shit, if they get audited, like what happens to this firm? Or like, you want somebody who's just dead fucking honest and that you can stand on behind that. And I think comedy is an amazing way to kind of like segue into that without being just like somebody who's really sharp around the edges and hard to deal with,
What's the funniest interaction you can either say someone specifically or just in generalities of a type of person that has reached out to you, DMs or whatever, being like, hey, what the fuck, stop making fun of us or whatever. Is there anything that you can point to like that?
What's interesting is like not so much. This has actually been kind of a refreshing experience for me, because it wasn't expected at all. But I get far more like, hey, I understand that I'm doing this. Well, how would you recommend me stopping or doing this in a way that's not as corny or a way that's a little bit cooler? Or like, I get a lot of people coming and being like, hey, can you give me advice? Because I didn't even realize that I looked like stupid doing this. What's the better way to do it?
This is a VC doing something cringy and you call them out on it and they send you a note being like, hey, can you help me not be cringy?
Yeah, like, hey, like, okay, if what I'm doing is like really whack, like how do I not be whack? That's like been far more the experience than like, fuck you, stop doing this. Like, which I really appreciate, because, people, and I think that's indicative of like the kind of industry that we're in, thank God, which is that people are willing to learn and adjust and, like try new things out. So I'm all for it, but yeah, like I'm lucky. There have been some people who have just been so upset and angry. And it's just like, to me, that says a lot more about you than any other aspect of this interaction, so.
Yeah, it is funny. I saw someone tweeted the other day, like, how can someone help me be funny? I want to be funnier. And I'm like, it's so well-intentioned. Like, you're trying, I know what you're going for here, but
it doesn't work like that, boss.
Yeah, this like right here is a problem, right? And I definitely see, I mean, my partner, Scott, I've talked about this before, gives me a lot of shit that I've perpetuated a in part like a cycle of people not trying to be funny that like aren't funny. And he's like, he'll send me a shitty tweet sometimes and be like, this is on you. Like, these blood is on your hands that this person is trying to be funny. I'm like, dude, I didn't tell him to do it. Be clear. Like, I don't deserve. And he's like, no, this is your fault that I have to see this shitty content on my feed. Right. It's pretty funny.
But to that point, at the end of the day, I would rather people try and fail than just be like weird, reclusive, like just the stereotypical cliche San Francisco Palo Alto guy. Like, that to me, generally, that's one of the worst people. And like, that archetype is one of the worst of all, like, anybody I know. So anytime that people are moving away from that, I'm all for it, even if the landings aren't soft sometimes.
I think most people have to come, like, in this industry, have to come from a perspective of like, hey, we don't know anything often. And so, like, I've made fun of crypto constantly for some. And now over the course of the last couple of years, I've just seen how galvanized the industry is behind this. And I'm like, you know what? Actually, I might not, all the jokes that I made about this stuff, and we'll see ultimately where all of it nets out and all the use cases. And I think like all the people that have poked fun at it probably are right. But you in the industry, you have to be open to being wrong and changing your mind and learning and adapting. Right. And I think that is something that people are obviously using in other ways as well to try to actually build a brand and figure out what resonates with them. And you can't go back to the like what Fred Wilson did or Tomash did back in 2009, 2012, whatever it was, that market's cornered. You can't keep doing that, right? And so it's good to see people actually learning and trying. It was one of the things when we started doing this podcast, so many people were like mad. And I was like, these things are infinitely scalable, right? Like, I'm not stealing anyone's podcast spot. And you know what? Like, it might work, it might not, but try.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
And so I guess that's one of my messages. If anyone listens to this and actually wants to start a podcast, I'm happy to help you and figure this out. Because, like, who knows? It's just, you don't have to listen and try this stuff. And maybe it'll work and maybe it won't.
And at the end of the day, the only people that are hating are people that aren't, like, confident enough in the product that they're putting out to not be worried about it, right? Like, Joe Rogan doesn't give a fuck if anyone starts a podcast, because why would he? You know, it's like, if you really believe in yourself and your ideas and, like, have, like, a strong level of self-confidence in the stuff that you're putting out, it 100% shouldn't matter. And at the end of the day, my feeling is that like a rising tide lifts all ships. So I think that the more people that you can get interested in this as a format, the better for everybody. So
yeah, the all-in guys were pretty funny. They've been very gracious to me. And someone started, like, when we launched, they're like, what is this? Just a shitty all-in. And one of them responded, or maybe it was Nick, their producer, responded like, yeah, I thought we had the market cornered for friends joking around and talking about tech stuff. He was like, I thought that was we had that trademarked or something, which I thought was pretty, funny. It's like, who cares, right? It's infinitely scalable. I'm not stealing shelf space from some other product, right?
Yep, totally.
It sounds like you're doing investing. Obviously, you've had to figure out how to obfuscate your identity in different ways, as we were talking about before you hopped on. Tell us a little bit about like what you're doing with that and where people can reach you and all that stuff.
For sure. So, like I said, I've been investing for quite a while now. I've probably done close to like 100 plus companies. And so, this is something that I'm very passionate about and feel like I have a very unique angle on. And then that only got sort of exacerbated by the page. And what I found really interesting and, something that nobody was really doing is there's no like investment funds, in my opinion, that run primarily on ideas. It's a lot of kind of what we were talking about earlier, which is these personas and these egos that exist in the valley that drive a lot of like the interest in specific funds and specific deals. And so to me, an experiment that I kind of tried or that I thought was interesting was, can you invest in companies just based on the strength of your ideas and not have it matter at all who you are, but just that people resonate with your beliefs? And so, launched the Exits Fund about a couple months ago. and have been investing a bit out of it pretty heavily. We've got 5 deals all over the world, a bunch of different sectors, and mainly doing seed and A. And if people are interested in working together or sending interesting things you are working on through, it's gp@prayingforexits.com. And I would love to see some decks and hear from people.
How do you think about, like, obviously you're in the industry as well. Is this just the stuff you're doing here just divorced from the stuff that you're focusing on in your full-time, not anonymous gig?
No, what I think is interesting about it is that it actually almost serves as like a scout fund for myself in a weird way. So I'm able to do much smaller and more flexible investing through that vehicle. And then hopefully over time, feed it up the chain and do bigger checks out of maybe the day job.
Yeah, got it. Okay. No, it's super cool. Do people, like, what do they get? Have you done any promotion of companies you've invested in on the Instagram account?
Yeah, but like, to me, that's kind of like the most lowbrow thing that I can do for people. Of course I could promote people in that way. But I think what's much more interesting is that, via the page and just via real life, like, I've accumulated a network, and this is like the most cliche fucking thing to say possible that a VC could say, but like, I think that there are a lot of people who are good VC connectors into purely the technology world. So they can introduce you to somebody at Oracle that can, sell your product through the entire fucking organization or whatever. And there's a lot of people like that. I think that there's a lot less people that are like cultural connectors and able to, promote relevance in a wide variety of different things, from software to consumer tech to, and that's kind of the space that I feel like is the most interesting to play. I'm going to be launching a website soon where you can see all the portfolio companies. But I would really, if you know any of the founders that I work with, please reach out to them and ask how I've been helping them. I guarantee none of them will say Instagram promotion as one of the first things. So
one of the topics we want to hit. So Tiger Global was to disclose their returns from the month of April as well as their returns year to date. So this in the first 4 months of the year, their assets under management across their two funds has fallen from $35 billion to $19 billion. Their main hedge fund posted a 15% decline in April, which put them at down 44% for the year. Their long only fund was actually hit even worse in April, falling 25% in the month and is down 52% for the year. Tiger declined to comment on all this, but obviously the numbers in some ways speak for themselves. And I think when we look out on the market today, we're recording this on a Thursday afternoon, and I think stocks definitely got clapped today as well. Ooh, after little bit of a rally yesterday. So I know Tiger is at the has been at the epicenter of a bunch of jokes as well as the industry over the course of the last 2 years. What's your thoughts on these numbers? Where do you think Tiger goes from here with all this?
I think what's unfortunate for Tiger is that they are, just have so much of the public spotlight and attention just due to how fast and how aggressively they were going over the last 2 or 3 years. And so it's kind of like a double-edged sword, right? In good times, you look kind of like a genius for going so hard and allocating that hard. And then in sort of more humbling times, you also still have that same level of spotlight. And I think what's interesting, and this is not specific to Tiger in general, but if you were to probably get a true mark on all of those private funds and you were to blend those together with the public funds, it'd probably look a lot more catastrophic than what we're seeing right now. And so what's interesting to me is, like, especially all of these funds that have started to do a lot of the crossover stuff, they don't really look too much to me like hedge funds anymore.
Well, there's not a lot of hedge.
Yeah, there's not a lot of fund, but not a lot of hedge, right? So
yeah.
It's to me, it seems interesting that everyone seems to be straying away from, like, what really sort of this industry was built on, which is risk-adjusted returns, not just like net returns. And so, I don't know. I think that it seemed like a lot of people thought that the musical chairs could never end, or they couldn't perceive what sort of macroeconomic event would really tip the scales in this way. And I think that there are a lot of positions on everybody's books, not just Tiger Global's, but small funds, big funds, that, you know, it'd be tough to sell those valuations in a real way right now. And so I think that realistically, a lot of people's books probably look like this. Maybe not because the public exposure is so high, but I think a lot of people's books probably look pretty ugly. And Tiger is just has the unfortunate sort of title of being the most relevant venture investor right now. So they're getting especially clapped.
It is interesting. I mean, this felt like, everyone for the longest time, when I've been in the industry at large for 12 years, I've been in venture for 8 now. Mm-hmm. And at every point, there's always a firm that people point to and say, hey, this is crazy, right? Yeah. And it was Andreessen Horowitz back in mm-hmm. the, you know, whatever, 2011, 12, 13, and people forget, but they were made fun of for doing GitHub at the price that they did, right? And doing Slack, and, you know, then it was Coatue for a little while, and then Tiger definitely took that mantle, or SoftBank was in there as well, I guess. It's interesting. I guess it'll be interesting to see their product is one that I think resonates with entrepreneurs, right? Obviously, who doesn't want access to this capital and this scale and the efficiency at which they operate, right? And so I think there's a good need for this product of some type in the market. People obviously liked that, but they were playing fast with diligence and prices and all of those things. I think the thing that I imagine will be their saving grace in all of this is that they've made people a lot of money, right? Mm-hmm. And like that 19 billion or going from 35 to 19, there's probably a lot of people that came in at the end of all of this. And those people mm-hmm. have only experienced losses. But there also are a lot of people that have made a ton of money being a part of Tiger, right? Of course. And so I think they're going to get a little bit more forgiveness than some of these groups over the course of the last 2 years that either started new or only started doing privates, right? And so mm-hmm. I imagine Tiger's going to be able to weather this, but I do think that there's probably some other hedge funds that have gotten exposure to privates recently that mm-hmm. haven't made people money, and mm-hmm. they're going to have a lot of problems, right? And so I think this is something of a canary in the coal mine for, honestly, a bunch of people to the adjacent of Tiger.
I would say so, too. And I just want to be perfectly clear that, you know, Scott and the rest of their team are some of the, you know, best investors that I know of generally. And
yeah, sure.
I don't think that over a long period of time that this is something that, you know, I'm not worried about Tiger. I'm not worried about their bonuses. I'm not worried about the Hamptons houses. Like, I think that they're going to be totally fine.
Yeah. Listen, I think some of the houses they purchased have been disclosed. I don't think anyone should be particularly worried about that. But yes, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So I think, you know, at the end of the day, what people need to remember is that this is a long game. And there are going to be definitely moments in time where these little blips happen. And I'm not even calling this necessarily a little blip, but, you know, I believe in the integrity of their ability to invest over a long period of time. And so while this is just a really unfortunate snapshot in time for their returns, I think over the long term, and to your point, like in the past, they're probably going to do just fine. So, but it is, again, there's a lot of people that have probably invested in the last 4 years who thought, oh, you know what, I'm just going to hop on this little train and see what happens. That like, I know a lot of hedge funds that have no business in doing privates, or of course doing privates. And so, it could get ugly on that side for sure.
Where do you think the shakeout lands? Like, do you think there ends up being, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 kind of broad hedge funds, and we've had 15, 20 that have been participating, and there's a pullback and, you know, only a few survive? Or what's your thought on this crossover market in particular, and the people that have historically been very hedge fund oriented?
Yeah, I think that the ones that have, to your point, been doing really well for the LPs over an extended period of time will have a level of trust that they'll probably be able to raise. You know, you looked at Melvin Capital earlier this year. And even when they were like marked down, I don't even know what it was, like 30% in a week, like they still had LPs willing to come in and support. And, you know, so I think that if you have a really strong brand name and you've been doing this for a really long time, I think that you're okay. But it's these sort of players who, you know, have been traditionally hedge funds for like a really long time, and then all of a sudden realize that, oh, the only alpha that I can maybe juice my alpha a little bit by also doing privates and not worrying about constant marks. I think for me, that that kind of indicates that those guys are probably going to get fucked over. And the ones that are able to continuously, or not continuously, but still able to maintain their stories with their LPs, which I feel like is, you know, a lot of the ones that we know and talk about often, you know, in 10 years, things are probably going to be fine. It's just how does it shake out over the short term?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, everyone says be greedy when others are fearful or whatever, like all the standard platitudes. And then you just see the lemmings, the mindset. Like it is against human nature, right, to not be fearful in this exact setting when the market's getting crushed the way it is.
Sure. Oh, dude. Yeah, especially when it fucking hurts. Like, yeah, when it hurts, it's hard. Like when it's like physically or psychologically painful, like nobody wants to continuously put up with that. But, you know, that's where, I mean, according to Warren Buffett, all the alpha is. So we'll see.
I've heard he's a pretty smart guy. So another thing I wanted to hit. So there's two different buckets of this. One, Business Insider got their hands on an internal memo from Facebook's CFO who said that there is a hiring freeze that's going to go on within the company for the rest of the year and reduced hiring targets that will affect almost every team in the company. So that was reported by Business Insider. It sounds like they got their hands on the memo. And then also we've seen a few different like 50 to 90 person layoffs that have happened this week from not huge companies, but ones that have raised a decent amount of capital. So Cameo disclosed that they were laying off 87 people. On Deck was laying off 72. Main Street said that they were going to lay off a third of their workforce, which looked like they had about 200 people from what I can tell on LinkedIn. So that would be about 65 or so. So I guess we shouldn't be surprised that some of this stuff is happening. What's interesting to me is while the broader market has pulled back for sure from a valuation standpoint, I've yet to see business fundamentals be impacted for the most part, right? It's like this is sort of a valuation-centric question. And I assume it's going to flow through, like, especially if you sell to other startups, inevitably this cut in spending and hiring and all that stuff will end up flowing through the economy. But it's interesting to see. I wonder to what extent these companies, these layoffs, or in the case of the private businesses, it's just extending runway versus the businesses are being impacted. But I credit to these companies and for me to getting out in front of this, right? Obviously, we saw Fast didn't do that and ran headfirst in the wall. So I don't know. Do you have any opinion about any of these companies specifically or just in general about like how much more carnage we're going to see here in the coming weeks and months for some of these startups?
I think that we're going to probably see a lot of carnage. Some will be forced carnage and some will be carnage by choice. It seems like these groups are taking the carnage by choice option, which I think is probably the most prudent option for most people because from where I sit and from the people that I talk to, it seems like burn is probably one of the most important metrics going right now and how people can manage burn. And so my just seeing these names and knowing where they are within their fundraising cycles, I would assume that this is a preemptive sort of action in order to say, hey, look, we're starting to manage burn. We're good for another round because look, we're like actually being, you know, prudent stewards of capital here. And you know, before you guys even asked us, we were already, you know, tightening our belt a little bit. So I think what you're going to start to see is there's going to be some companies who, and like, to be honest, like, I don't even know what 87 people at Cameo are doing or like 72 people. Like, that's a lot of fucking people. And like, these businesses, in a lot of senses, don't really need that. I think that, like, we've been tricked by COVID and a lot of other things into letting these businesses bloat a lot. And I think it's almost like one of those things where people were actually hiring more so that they could get a larger round because they could say, hey, listen, look at how big our team is. This is what it costs to run our team. We actually need X much larger of a round because, you know, if we want runway to keep this team and keep growing it, then we need X amount of money. And so I think people are finally being like, actually, what the fuck are all those people doing at your company? And that is probably going to be one of the most poignant questions asked of a lot of late stage companies moving forward. In my opinion, is what the fuck are all these people doing here and why are they here?
Yeah.
And if you don't have like a very good justifiable reason, then you're going to start to see the forced carnage. So that's my take.
I mean, it's never easy to do this. I will say all of these companies specifically, I didn't see any blowback in the better.com way about how it was handled. Like, I actually saw some anonymous compliments from people about the maturity of it. And this is always a hard thing to handle. I guess the Cameo guy did tweet out the thing using his profile on Twitter, and his PFP was a Bored Ape Yacht Club image, which, you know, is maybe a sign of excess. And so you might want to change that when you're signing off.
It's like firing someone with like a brand new Patek Philippe on.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Pointing at them and saying this way to the door, and you're, you know, whatever.
With your gold, Nautilus.
Yeah. 500,000 watches there as well. But yeah. Credit to these. I'm sure it wasn't an easy decision to come to, but getting out in front of some of these things and just extending your runway, it's the fair thing to do to these employees, or for these employees and for their investors and the companies as well. And so I'm sure it was really difficult, but credit to all of them for doing it.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, it's 100% is a really tough thing to do. But if you're thinking about the company as a whole and the survival of a company, in some cases it's necessary. It's like cutting off like a frostbitten limb. You know, if you want to survive in general, you might have to make some sacrifices. And so it's definitely a hard thing to do. And you know, it's a shitty thing to do, but in some cases very necessary. So sucks to all the people that are affected by it. But hopefully, you know, all these things turn around and we get back to a place where there's more hiring than firing.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Didn't want to lead with this because we've talked about this, I think, every week, and I imagine we'll continue to talk about it. But it was disclosed this week, two things about Elon Musk. So number one, it seems like he's going to act as the interim CEO when he takes over Twitter. And then also he did get $7 billion in financing for the deal from a group of 19 different investors. And so this will decrease the amount that he needs to borrow against his Tesla stake. And so he won't need to put up as much. It was an interesting cast of characters. It was Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal from Saudi Arabia, who was the number one most committed to putting up the financing. So he was going to put in $1.9 billion. Then the other cast of characters, I guess there were 18 of them, but the notable ones from my perspective, Larry Ellison put up $1 billion. Sequoia put up $800 million. Andreessen Horowitz put up $400 million. Binance put up $500 million and DFJ Growth put up $100 million. There are a bunch of connections between those people and Elon. So Sequoia, I believe, was an investor in SpaceX, and they just recently announced an investment in The Boring Company. Larry Ellison sits on Tesla's board. DFJ Growth invested in The Boring Company, Tesla, SolarCity, and SpaceX. Steve Jurvetson, their former partner and one of their namesakes, is very close with Elon, as I understand it. And then Binance developed some trading in tokenized version of Tesla stock or something. That was maybe the weird one, but Binance seems like a weird company as well. So I'm a little surprised by the cast of characters here. We had only heard that there were big private equity firms kind of circling. It's not totally surprising that this is viewed a little bit more as a venture bet than it is a private equity one, given the cash dynamics of the business. Are you surprised to see this list of names and big venture firms participating in this?
No, I'm surprised that there's honestly not more. I mean, if you really think about what they're buying into and what they're buying a piece of, you're buying a piece of global culture, right? And I don't know how to value that, but having influence on the nexus for where almost 100% of the most important topics in the world are openly debated seems to me like a very, very... It seems to me like the value in that is going to extend far past a financial sort of return. Although, you know, if it is executed properly, I do think that Twitter has been a fantastically poorly run business, and there's a lot of opportunities to commercialize it and create revenue in ways that were just basically completely ignored for the last 10 years. And so, yeah, I think that it's a great bet in the sense that there's obviously a chance that this could be very financially lucrative. But even more so, I think that everybody who participated in this is playing a 3D chess in the sense that, you know, if you can control the public narrative, and not saying that everybody on the cap table is going to have like their hands in this like Illuminati pot, just, you know, moving the algorithm around to whatever benefits them. But I do think that being as close as possible, it's like, to me, like buying something like the fucking New York Times back in whenever, the 1950s or 60s. You're taking a bet on the fact that if you have some sort of influence on the way that the platform is executed, then by some extension, you have an influence on culture. And I think that that's a very valuable thing and worth every cent, to be honest.
Yeah, it makes sense. I guess some people were speculating that it was going to be a venture bet. And I think the level of plan Elon's articulated about where the company is going to go feels very much like a venture style investment, right? Where not all the details are fleshed out, but clearly this is a very strategic asset that's been under-optimized that is going to have a world-class cast of characters probably around the table helping out. And so it's interesting as this is sort of played out in real time. Elon started from the framework of, hey, this isn't a financial thing for me, which I actually believe that it wasn't when he did that on the TED Talk interview stage or whatever it was. So I believe that it wasn't thought through. I think increasingly, probably when he realized how much capital he was going to have at stake, he recognized that that making it more of a financial investment and getting more financial oriented people involved is probably a good thing. I guess my big question is how that's going to impact the product decisions, right? Because obviously he's been pretty vocal about and Jack Dorsey has as well of how advertising has somewhat held back what they can do with the platform. And but that's 90% of their revenue today, right? And so it'll be interesting where this like free speech dynamic, that the public good that he was talking about originally, where that stops and where the turning this into as good of a business as it actually can be starts. And so yeah, I trust this is only going to be the beginning of us talking about all of these things.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we're going to see, I think that it would be surprising to not see the influence of all of these people in some way, shape, or form, and however this turned out next.
One of the things that also popped up this week was Neeraj Arora posted a long Twitter thread about selling. He was the chief business officer at WhatsApp, and he said that he helped sell it for $22 billion to Facebook. And he went through and said how he regretted it and how a bunch of decisions that were made by Facebook and some of the promises that were made at the time of acquisition were not kept. And that includes no ads, seems to be one of the big ones that they said, no mining of user data, no cross-platform tracking. And he said that Facebook and their management team agreed and believed in their mission. Ultimately, I think people probably know how the WhatsApp acquisition has played out. There has been more. They have not held to all of those things all the way through. Brian Action, who was one of the co-founders of WhatsApp, came out and I think in 2018 spoke out pretty publicly about why it was time to delete Facebook. It's interesting that this comes out now. I'm not quite sure what Neeraj Arora's intentions are with it. It does seem that he is launching a new app that is a privacy focused one. And so it is a serendipitous timing and some shameless self-promotion after selling this company for $22 billion to Facebook, crying wolf at this point. But it's gotten a ton of traction, 34,000 likes as of the current recording. And it was published about 24 hours ago. So it's certainly going high and wide and seems to validate. It's one of these things that seems to validate what people's opinions are already. If you believe that Facebook is poorly intentioned and everything they're doing, then this seems to validate that. But it does seem a little self-serving to be. Do you have any opinions about what the Neeraj's take is here?
Yeah, I think it's a completely self-promotive in the sense that it's just great timing that he has a new app launching. Nothing wrong with that, I guess. But I think the heartstring that it might be pulling on a lot of people is, I'm sure a lot of people in our industry have had that experience where they've poured their heart and soul into a product that they really love and that they really believed in, and that they believe that the mission that they were focused on initially was the one that best served that product. But I think that everybody should be aware of, and I don't know how people aren't, that when you sell your company to another company, you're kind of making a deal with the devil in the sense that that's no longer your company. Like, all of the love and the, it's like when you, I don't know, sell a car and someone goes and puts like a god-awful ugly body kit on it, even though it was like a beautiful Ferrari when you started with it. It's like, yeah, understandable. Like, everybody was kind of playing for the same team at one point, but it's the owner of the actual thing that gets to decide what they do with it. And with $22 billion in your pocket, it's one of those things where it's like, if you're actually complaining about how that all shifted, then I understand that you really believed in your mission. But at this point, it just seems like you're complaining from like a mansion somewhere while you're about to launch a new product that'll make you potentially even richer. So,
yeah, exactly. It's like that Woody Harrelson where he's crying and wiping money with his tears, right? Using dollar bills to wipe his tears away. It's kind of like, dude, cry me a river. You sold your business for $22 billion, like one of the biggest acquisitions in history. And now, because you're being opportunistic about your launch of this app, you're coming out with the story. And so everyone's going to be self-serving in all this. And it's I think, our job, and it's incumbent on people that read news in general to assume what different people's intentions or biases are in this. And this is so explicitly convenient for him to be coming out with this story now that it's like, what did you think was going to happen after this? And thankfully I was scrolling through the comments and it seems like most people are calling him out on this, but it spread virally. And most people that see that thread probably aren't going to unpack, you know, how self-serving this whole thing is.
But it's also really easy to hate Meta right now. So, I mean, like, I can't really say how much of that is just like, fuck Mark Zuckerberg, you know?
Yeah, I assume the virality is just like, this is a chum for the people that want to hate on Facebook, right? And it's like, look at this founder.
For sure. It's just another thing that Mark fucked up on. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Look at this founder chief business officer that helped negotiate the sale to WhatsApp. And now he too is coming out against it, right? And it's like, give me a break.
Yeah. And like, also the founders seem to be very quiet on their yachts, just enjoying their life. So, I mean, who's really angry here?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's exactly right. They're crying while they're shoveling more money for gas into their yacht right now. So I think everyone's doing okay. And again,
totally, especially with oil prices, it's about, yeah.
It's a good lesson in general. Like, if you're selling your house, right, you don't get a say on, back to your car example, like, you don't get a say if someone knocks down one of the walls or something, right, and changes it. You walked away, you made a financial deal with someone, and like,
even if they loved the house at the time, it's their house. Like,
it's their house now, right? And they might have said always we will always do something, and then they change their mind, and you know what, that's their prerogative, they own it. And you have 22 billion reasons to walk away and not cry about it, and you know, so it is,
for sure. And a whole new company to focus on. So I don't know what, like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But amazing promotion. I assume this is going to get more attention on his app. So here we are, right?
Yeah, I mean, look at us. We're promoting right now.
All right. Well, that concludes the final episode of 3 Cartoon Avatars and the first episode of Cartoon Avatars. Mr. Exits, thank you for joining. Hopefully this was fun for you, and maybe we can make this a regular guest appearance where we knock out some of this stuff.
For sure. Happy to do that. And thank you guys so much for having me. It was an honor. And yeah, always down to come talk some shit. So hit me up.
Yeah, exactly. Where can people find you? Find you on Instagram and Twitter?
Yeah, at Praying for Exits. Yeah, come say hi.
Good deal. What you're about to hear is a conversation that I had with 3 different Bored Ape Yacht Club experts. I had posted to Twitter, who knows the most about Bored Ape Yacht Club, and I had gotten a number of recommendations. And so I decided to have 3 of them on to talk about what's going on with Bored Ape Yacht Club, Other Side, Yuga Labs, all of that stuff. So excited for you to hear it now. So special topic panel we got here. So over the weekend, one of the big things that happened that I was interested in was we've talked about Bored Apes in the past and Yuga Labs, the company behind Bored Apes. And so I am not particularly well-versed in weighing in on this subject. I've made, I guess I've moved past the slope of enlightenment where I was making a bunch of jokes about crypto to now believing that there's stuff actually going on here, but I'm not at the point of actually understanding what's going on. So I figured I would get people that actually do understand what's going on this this topic to kind of talk through what happened over the weekends. I am joined today by three special guests. I'm going to do a round the horn for people to introduce themselves and maybe give a little bit of context of why you were suggested to me in my Twitter mentions as someone that could weigh in on the subject. So I'm just going to go in order as they appear on my screen. But Alex, do you want to give kind of a quick background on yourself and your affiliation with Bored Apes and Yuga?
Sure. So Alex Taub, based in Miami, I'm the co-founder and CEO of a company called Upstream. We build like DAO infrastructure. So sort of like a DAO in the box. Been a holder for a long time, over a year now, for Yuga. So I think that's we've crossed the long-term capital gains. Little small investor in Yuga, the company, participating in the round, own two OG apes, two mutants, a dog, a bunch of land.
That's great. Well, we'll get into apes, mutants, dog, and land. I imagine people know what all those words mean, but probably not in the context that you are using them. So next up, Tropo Farmer. Please give us a little bit of context yourself.
How's it going, Tropo Farmer? OG apes fan, been there since day zero, like one of the first 50 people in the Discord. Very strong early supporter. And just big proponent of the community and Yuga Labs and the Bored Ape Yacht Club in general. One OG ape, three mutants, four dogs, some land, and a bunch of merch. Aside from that, I'm just kind of a general Twitter shit poster and also do advising and investing as well. And I'm also a Yuga investor. Very, very small.
Good. Okay. Well, clearly biased people here as you're weighing in on the subject. Everyone, please recognize the conflicts that exist here. Okay, and last but certainly not least, Mags.
Hi, I'm Mags. I'm a consumer venture investor, kind of at the intersection of culture and crypto. One OG ape holder, one mutant holder, not an investor in Yuga the company. And I'm here probably because I'm a queen of hot takes and like one of five women in the entire Yuga ecosystem. So
good. Well, we could talk about that. Maybe that'll come up. Maybe it won't. But yes, Mags, thanks for joining us. So over the weekend, Yuga Labs, the creators of Bored Ape Yacht Club, launched a sale of their virtual land for their highly anticipated metaverse project that raised $320 million worth of cryptocurrency, but it was in their native ape coin, which we'll talk about what that actually means. The criticism or the reason that this was interesting is that it also resulted in about $180 million of transaction fees in Ether that went to people that were actually staking Ethereum. For the transaction. So I guess, did I get that version right? Our second outtake in trying to do this, is that closer to accurate?
I think you're good.
Alex, maybe weigh in a little bit. There's some question about basically, is this a feature or a bug that all this transaction fees existed? Some people have equated it to an app. An Apple release, right, where people line up around the block and the opportunity to skip the line from the apps to get access to this. Did this work as intended, or is this actually a bug that exists, you know, in their approach?
I don't think, you know, there's a lot of people who think there's like a conspiracy theory that they like want to create their own chain and they did it on purpose. And that doesn't really line up with how I think of them. And that is not because I'm a tiny, tiny, tiny investor. They basically went to all the Bored Ape owners and they basically said, hey, if you want to participate in the round, you can, which I thought was a nice thing. So it's not, expect any profit or any return from that. I just wanted to support because I love being part of it. But in terms of this specific thing, I mean, they could have done the drop better. There's a lot of different examples of ways that people have done drops recently that did not lead to all this, you know, these mining fees. So they could have done a raffle. They could have done, they could have given one spot to people. And then they could have given people a longer time to go. Everyone has a spot. And once everyone gets a spot, then we could do a little bit of a gas war. So having 2 hours of, you know, elevated gas was probably not something that they wanted. And I don't think that anyone really felt good about it. So it is and was an issue.
It seemed like a little bit like some of the criticism related to it was obviously some of the points that you made about they could have done this better, thought through different stuff. And it sounds like you don't think this was a hype building exercise, right? Like intentionally creating mania behind something to draw more attention to the project.
I mean, it's really tough. You're trying to sell 55,000 plots of land. You know what I mean? People keep forgetting, like, or like people who've never been involved in like a product launch or like you're trying to sell 55,000 plots of land for about 2 ETH each. Like, you don't know what's going to happen.
And 2 ETH is right now about $5,000 roughly, right?
Well, more like $6,000, but it was 2 ETH, but it was equivalent of 305 ApeCoin, which at the time was about $20 right when the mint happened. So I'm interchangeably using different currencies across, but about $6,000. So you just don't know what's going to happen. So I don't think there was some like massive conspiracy. Also, historically, Yuga, Bored Ape, they just have not been great at launches. They're great at a lot of things, but like if you actually look back, it took like a week for them to sell out the original project, which I'm not saying, you know, good, bad, you sell out in 2 seconds versus a week. It was also a different time. But Mutant Apes, nobody knew what was happening when the mint was happening for Mutant Apes. People forget that like they just put it out there and they've never been great at communication on like what's going on. And that's also part of the game. You know what I mean? Like right now, we don't really know like what the value of different things are. We don't know what the value of a coda is, which is something we'll probably talk about in a few minutes. We don't know the value of the resources. We don't know the value of the artifacts that are on this land. Nobody knows. They're not, and they could tomorrow just explain it all. But part of the game is figuring that out.
And when you're saying game in a literal sense, so maybe we can back up to the top about Bored Ape. So how did you guys originally get exposed to this? How did it come to be? When did you get involved? And like, what's the relationship between Bored Ape, the actual NFT versus the company versus the land and all that? I guess maybe zooming out a bit, like what are we even talking about here? So obviously people understand at a high level what NFTs are and what that concept is. And we've walked through what Yuga is versus Bored Apes. But Tropa, it sounds like you're kind of an OG here. Can you take us back to like, what even is this thing that we're talking about?
I mean, at its core, like this is a community, the Bored Ape Yacht Club's based on ownership of this NFT. That's where it all started. That's where it's all sprung from. That's where it continues to be focused on. You know, you had the community that started last spring with the drop there that flowed into their airdrop, which was given to holders with their dogs. And then at the end of the summer, you had the sale of mutants, which is what Alex talked about. And now you've got other side, which again was like given as a free claim for holders of the BAYC apes and mutants. So in terms of like how those are related, you know, Yuga's the company that's created both of those, but BAYC and other side don't necessarily have a direct connection. Legally, they're separated. The communities are separated, but there's a ton of overlap between the participants in both ecosystems.
The NFT launched originally last spring, right? Whenever that was, and it took a week to sell out. And then there was a big focus and it became kind of a cultural phenomenon. And they launched subsequent things after that. So then there was Mutants, and it sounds like...
Yeah, Mutants was kind of the next collection to expand the ecosystem. So you had 10,000 Bored Apes. Now you have 20,000 Mutants. 10,000 of those were given to Bored Apes. So conceivably, you've kind of doubled the size of the community with that launch.
And the community is about ballpark 10,000 people. What's, you know, as you guys are in these Discord servers?
I think in terms of unique holders of a mutant or an ape, it's probably about 10 to 15,000.
So this is a community of 10 to 15,000 people that all have different NFTs. And now Yuga raised money, a couple months ago from Andreessen Horowitz and Thrive and a handful of other people. And so now that is with the objective of building this other side game, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Great.
That is, in my opinion, like the next way that they can expand this ecosystem is by having this drop that so many new people can participate in that have been priced out of mutants and apes. And granted, $6,000 is still like, that's still a lot of money. And when you put on these gas fees on top of that, it basically has doubled the cost. So you're still excluding a lot of folks who wanted this to be their first entry into this ecosystem just by virtue of price and really just knowledge. Like, it wasn't enough to just have money. You needed to also know how to kind of play the game to get to be able to buy this thing. So in terms of like, has this succeeded in expanding the ecosystem? Like, yeah, kind of, but like it, in my opinion, like it could have been done much, much better.
Well, it sounds like you and Alex both agree that like this could have been orchestrated better and all that. But Mags, we were talking before and it feels like you might disagree a little bit about just how involved the community is and or how well they're able to handle the community and whether or not this is actually democratizing access for other people to come in.
Well, a lot of different ideas and thoughts there, right? So one, I think when you look at this drop, there's like three elements to it. There's the who was the target audience, what was the objective for the drop, and what is the long-term vision for Other Side and Yuga and all of that, right? And like I'm only guessing of like what the team was thinking, what the team was solving for. If it was about expanding access to the ecosystem, this was like a very complicated way to do it that ended up being like having a poor results. I don't think it was malicious intent. I think it was just underestimating how much demand there was going to be and all the kind of issues came out of that, right? If it was about not that and actually just deepening the ecosystem and to current holders and, you know, you got your free claim, but you also could get more piece of land by buying them, etc. Like, this is not how you treat your customers in your community, right? Like, this was also not a good experience for those people because you wouldn't expect to get that level of treatment from people who were like supporting you day one. So regardless of like which objective you pick, it wasn't a great outcome, but not because of malicious intent. It was just probably some level of underestimating demand, thoughtlessness, some hubris, right? Like, combination of things that were not, intentionally trying to like get people. I think like there are three types of archetype of buyers, right? There was the super active NFT trader. And if you lost money on gas, like, I don't feel sorry for you because it was a greed-driven behavior, right? Like, if you're a super big trader and you like, you pumped up gas for a reason because you wanted to like get your allocation. Like, if you lost money on it, like, I don't actually feel that bad because if you didn't think it was worth it, you wouldn't do it. Then there's the like the second archetype, which is relatively frequent NFT trader who just isn't part in the ecosystem because they are priced out. They cannot afford a mutant. They cannot afford an ape at current prices, right? And they wanted to be part of the ecosystem. And with those folks, like, I do feel kind of bad because that is like their introduction to the Yuga ecosystem. And it was a poor experience, right? Like, they were not trying to buy 10 or 20 or whatever. Like, they just wanted like their one piece of land to be part of the community. And then there is the like the third customer archetype that like I feel really bad about. And it's people for whom it might have been their first NFT. It was a horrible drop to be a part of if that was like one of your first purchases. But if you think of like that customer profile, and I use the customer very intentionally here, it's people who've been scared of the NFT game. And Yuga has consistently been the one thing that like almost guaranteed that you would make money. And so if you are going to like finally put some money on the line and try to participate, like it felt like one of those things, you know what, like I'm going to make money here. This is a good project with a good team, with good investors. Like, why not like, you know, take a shot here. And those I feel particularly bad about because I think it turned a lot of people off kind of playing the game and trying to learn more and participate.
As you think about those three different buckets, like what number of people that I assume the people from left or from first to last, the people that got access to it versus not, probably the first group you talk about are probably the ones that got the most access, right? And the last group probably is the one that paid most of the gas fees. But as you think about this from a user standpoint, not from a number of apes or mutants or that, like, do you think it's 50% the first, 25, 25? What do you think the split is?
I haven't looked at the data, and you can kind of tell the data, right? Because you can just analyze the wallets that participated. So I don't want to speculate because I literally haven't taken a look at it. I would guess that the 80-20 of it was the kind of the active NFT ecosystem, but you probably don't have a lot of other NFTs from Yuga, because those are the people who are like most excited about participating and joining, right? Because if you are already a holder, like you were going to get your free claim, you probably wanted to add some like Alex here did. So it's definitely much heavier on kind of the more active in the NFT game you are, the more likely you were to actually benefit, which again, rewards kind of expertise and being deep in the weeds as opposed to expanding the ecosystem to more general users. And like that to me is a big issue, right? It's like, how do you think about that in context of the vision? Because if the vision is to be a kind of the mainstream platform a la Sandbox, where you get mass market to kind of participate and play and then be part of it, like you can't run drops like this. But if this is supposed to be for this like very passionate community subculture within the space, with like this complicated game within a game within a game, like maybe that's okay. And then just communicate that accordingly.
You touched on a bunch of interesting things there, but one of the ones, I guess, at a fundamental level, Alex, or I would love to get your thoughts on, are what has caused this level of intrigue into this? Mags made the point that like this might be the introduction into the NFT ecosystem for a lot of people. I would imagine this is, you know, maybe the only one. If you ask someone, a random person on the street, if they could come up with an NFT, this is probably the one they can come up with. What is it fundamentally that has caused this level of intrigue? Is it the art itself? Is it the community? Is it the speculation? What is it that has made this such a center of the cultural zeitgeist?
It's a great question. I think it's different for different people. You know, going back to like why I got in, I host a weekly event every Friday at 1 o'clock with a guy named Drew Austin. And we talk about NFTs, and we've been doing this for basically a year. And the mint on that, like that Friday, we were talking about it. A bunch of us bought. And I remember I looked back and I saw the text I sent to Drew. I was like, I really like this because of this is the first NFT that I'm seeing that like explicitly says, like, if you own an ape, you are part of this community. It was like a membership gate to this yacht club. And I thought that was really cool because CryptoPunks were before, and they were sort of like never explicitly saying like you're either a whale or an OG and you're part of this special community. But like the community sort of came around. It's like, oh, if you have a CryptoPunk, you're part of this special community. But Bored Ape was the first one to do that. So that was what initially interested me. I think what now, you know, at least what, why this was exciting is historically, you know, Bored Ape is the safest bet in the entire NFT ecosystem. Like, right before the drop, everything was all time highs, you know? And I think that, you know, this was like, everyone says like, don't fade Yuga. Like, just cause like, you know, you've historically been wrong anytime you wanted to sell. I owned with Drew, we owned like 4 or 6 apes. Like we sold them on the way up. And, I like that I brought new people into the community, but like, I didn't like selling an ape at 10 ETH. That doesn't feel good.
That's a good way of justifying the loss. Is it's really, you know, it's about I democratized access to it. I'm gonna remember that next time I sell a stock way too low on the rise up. It's like, no, I just wanted to get someone else into the, you know, owning those shares. I like that. Tropa, what in terms of like the brand of Bored Ape Yacht Club, Yuga? Clearly, we're talking about this, right? And like, I think my average listener is probably not as deep in all of this, but I look and people are definitely intrigued about this. And here we are doing a special segment about which I've never actually done before. So clearly, this is in some ways magnifying the lens of Bored Apes that, you know, all publicity is good publicity, right? To some extent. But on the other hand, there's people that are actually pissed off and lost money, right? Is this whole thing net negative for Bored Ape because of the backlash, or hey, here we are talking about it and it's staying relevant in the cultural zeitgeist?
Yeah, I don't think it's net negative for NFTs for Yuga. It's obviously net negative for those people who wanted to participate and couldn't. But you know, with this space, what happens is people move on very, very quickly. You know, things move so rapidly that, like, it's only been not even a week since that drop, and it feels like the sentiment has kind of already evaporated. Like, we've moved on. Like, let's focus on what's coming next. Let's see what they can deliver. But to make this point, like, a lot of people, this was their first experience with NFTs. I've heard other apes say, like, I got my friends together. We hung out that night. We did the drop together. Like, it was exciting. And then when you push that buy button and you see the cost, like, go up and up and up, and suddenly you're like, oh, I didn't pay enough. Like, I'm not going to get this thing. And there was like a couple hours where you're just kind of on edge waiting to see if this thing that you just agreed to spend $10,000 on is actually going to sell to you, which is just, it's a weird idea for that to be your first experience. So those people for sure negative. Hopefully they understand kind of what happened, why that situation happened.
It's an interesting point. So we've used colloquially game, right? Like we've referred to the literal game itself, right? They're coming out with a game. And then Mags, you made a reference to the game within the game and all this intrigue. And you know, it's almost like I've made this analogy with Elon Musk before. You're not sure what's intentional, like what part of it is eight-dimensional chess that he's playing versus what part of it's like accidental, right? And some of that leads to intrigue and speculation. You're like, how much is he moving eight steps ahead of where I am versus making stuff up as they go along, right? So maybe when you were the one that originally made the reference to game within the game and all that, can you talk a little bit about, like, what is the game at a meta level? I guess that's a bad term because they're actually creating a meta game, but at a zoomed out level, what is the game? And then at a zoomed in level, what is the game?
Well, I think there's like three levels of the game if we are going to get complicated here, right? Like, there's the actual game with the land, which, you know, you can call it a metaverse, you can call it a virtual world, you can call it a game, but like it will be a playable ecosystem.
They're working with a game studio to build that out, and we don't know exactly what it's going to be, but they've released a trailer that shows, you know, some cool imagery around it, right? And so we know a game's on the come. That was what the fundraise was about. That's what they've talked about publicly.
Yes. And the land that we just discussed is very much a core part of that product and kind of participation in that ecosystem, right? Then the second layer of game is like just the NFT game and how you think about, you know, how the company thinks about launching the product, how they think about managing their community, how they think about their role in the larger like NFT ecosystem. And then there is the game like outside of that, which is like the NFTs within the world overall and kind of the consumer attention and consumer economy, right? Like Tim Sweeney at Epic has a very different views of like where all of that is going versus some of us, you know, I mean, all of us in the Web3 space, we fundamentally believe in kind of the model as deployed by Yuga. But you kind of like, you know, you keep stepping up and stepping out and stepping out. I do think that in many ways, like, to Alex's point, Yuga has done everything right with the products and delivering value to the holders. And they haven't been so good with a bunch of other things like communication, like some of these drops, etc. Like, we have to remember this is a less than a 1-year-old startup. And so it's one of those things where you're just truly drinking from the fire hose and like growing really fast and have a lot of expectations associated with that. At the same time, like, I do have the take of, you know, with power and stature comes responsibility. And like what you get away with as a 5-person team just experimenting in the space is very different than like what you can get away with as the dominant player with like hundreds of millions in venture funding, right? And so like you have to deal with those challenges differently. And so I think the game within the game, the aspect there is also like their meta has changed. Like, they're no longer this scrappy little startup that gets to experiment and fuck up and like keep going. Like, they have to take responsibility and they have to think differently about it going forward.
Did your sympathies change for in level of forgiveness you would have for mistakes? Did that change as the hype behind it went up and the value of the NFTs went up and all that? Did it change when they took outside capital? Or is this just kind of like the expectations have always been high since the original launch?
I wouldn't say it was like a high from the initial launch, but like the more dominance you have in the ecosystem, and that manifests itself in a bunch of different ways, right? It's the like how much people take your actions as signaling of the larger NFT ecosystem, how many resources you have to fix issues or like do drops, and then how many like amazing people around the table you have to help you think through those problems, right? Like they just score like 10 out of 10 on every single one of those dimensions. Like there is no other project that comes close right now. And so like unfortunately, they might not like it, but their actions and their kind of activities like reflect on the larger NFT ecosystem in the Web3 space, especially when then it becomes this fodder for, you know, news stories that scare like regular people from participating and engaging because it kind of feeds a certain level of narrative.
Tropa, do you think, I mean, you've been involved in this, the group that's behind Yuga, one, are these the OGs that actually launched? I know they were doxxed and whatever, like, is that actually them? And do you think they appreciate the magnitude of their actions and how much of a lens is on them, and that, you know, at large, people are going to judge NFTs rightly or wrongly on some of the mistakes that they maybe make?
I think that's kind of the question, is like, how much are they involved in other side? You know, I think there's no question that those founders and the vision that they have for BAYC is still being executed. But now that they've taken in all this money and they have partners like Animoca, the question being asked is like, how much of this is being driven by people other than them? And how strongly do those people believe in the foundations of the community and the company? And how are they executing that with other side? So hopefully, and I think we've seen that with at least the art and the trailers produced, like I still do feel like those founders and their vision and creativity are still coming through. If you actually take a dive into the project and look at the depth of what's been created so far, it's very clear that they are passionate about it. And I hope that that doesn't get lost. Back when BAYC launched, like I was having like just DMs with Gordon, one of the founders, and this was back when NFT projects were, people were kind of jaded with them last spring, which is so weird to think about, but like, you know, it was kind of like these somewhat fly by night projects. You'd have a community that sprang up around the hype, and the sale happened and people either vibed with it and it kind of grew a little bit, or they sold and exited and things just dissipated. So the joke was like, you know, I can't wait to not talk to any of you in a month, right? And he's like, no man, like we're different, like we're gonna do this right, we have a vision, we're gonna execute, like people will want to participate in this, we're here for the long run. And I believed it. And they've still proven that to be true. So hopefully that's not lost with the expansion, with all this money that's coming in, with all the outside influences. As long as those people have respect for what was established back then and continues to be proliferated by the community, then I think we'll be fine.
Animoca is the game studio they're working with, right? To help develop other side. Is that right?
Yeah, them and actually there's another company too called Improbable that I think is handling the engine itself and the actual game development. So
okay, no, that makes sense. Alex, do you agree with that assessment of like where they are right now, and what are like the actionable takeaways for both them and the community at large? From, I mean, clearly they're blazing new ground, right? With everything they're doing at this scale, like CryptoPunks was the OG that was sort of held up in this venerable light. But now we're well beyond that in terms of the ambitions for Bored Ape Yacht Club, and Yuga Labs and all of that. Do you agree with Tropo's assessment there? And like, what are the lessons in this?
Yeah, you know, I sort of mentioned this a little bit before, but I think when I see people tweeting out like, the game's not coming for another year or two, like, what are you all doing? I'm like, The game's already begun. The game, this is the game. And it's very clear that the founders and the team there could clear it all up in 5 seconds. They could drop a video, explain everything. They probably have everything written up in a Google Doc somewhere. Like, they could just do it. But this is already part of the game. Part of the game is figuring out what is a coda? What is an artifact? What is resources on your land? What's valuable? Maybe we all have it wrong in that if you don't have any resources on your land, it's actually really valuable because then you could build stuff on your land. Like, I don't know, but that's a theory that some people have.
I guess is an interesting detail is that some of this stuff isn't.
No, none of it is. And it's not some of it. It's none of it is.
You're sort of you're diving in headfirst without fully knowing what you're diving into, right?
They made people KYC without telling them what it was for. I mean, that was a big mistake in and of itself. But the people have no idea. Is it valuable to be very close to the yacht club? Seems some people think that, and they're buying tons of land. Because if you look at the map on the website, the closest stuff to the yacht club is going for insane prices. So it's like, maybe that's valuable. But does anyone know that for a fact? I don't think so. Like, there's never been an announcement that, like, the closer you are to the actual yacht club, it's more valuable.
Packy McCormick, a friend of our the podcast, who also, I guess, will be added on as a interview with Ben Thompson and he that I did to this episode. But Packy wrote a great piece about the great online game and sort of talking about how everything we're doing to some extent is some version of this game. But is all of this like this intrigue and game that's going on in this? Like, it seems as if that's a feature of all of this. And people enjoy that. I use the Lost analogy of the television show, right? Where you're not really sure what's purposeful or not in the whole thing. And some of that's fun. If it all ties together in the end, if they're all just making shit up as they go along, you're going to be pretty disappointed at the end. Is that a fair analogy for kind of what we're living through?
Yes, because you have to believe that they actually have a larger plan. And I think the attention to detail means that they do. Like, for example, every pile of land has a little like entrance area, like codas, which are these little like these beings that there's 10,000 of them on randomly on the 100,000 plots. We don't really know what they do, but in the trailer, they fly. So maybe and in the deck that was, you know, that was like distributed in for Yuga, like it says current coda. So maybe that means the coda could be on a different land. You can move your coda. For example, I happened to get very lucky and I minted the most rare thing out of all things. I minted Chaos Land.
Oh.
Which there's only 100 and...
You lucky son of a bitch.
Yeah, I got very lucky. The floor is like 100 each.
I don't even know what that means. So that's worth... That is worth $300,000 or something?
Yeah, about. I mean, that's the floor for it. So I luckily minted that. And there's theories going around that like Chaos Land will let you teleport in the... you know, Yuga universe, and people will pay you to use your teleport. There's only 108 of them. You know, I have standing offers for 60 to 90 ETH on it almost every single day. I'm not selling it because I don't know what it really is. I don't know if it's more valuable than that. Maybe it goes to zero. Maybe it's worth millions of dollars. I have no idea, but that's what I'm saying. Like, that's sort of the game, so the people who are saying the game's not coming for year two, they're missing the point that the game's already begun. And if you can figure out what it is, whether you find out information or, you know, you speculate on something, you could be rewarded. And that's why the expertise here really comes to play. Like, for example, I'm in a DAO. There's 15 of us. There's 29 of us. Some people didn't have enough money to afford the mint. Some people did. We all band together. We put together about $100,000 and we ended up buying 15 plots of land during the mint. And we were coordinating and we realized you need to up the gas if you really want to get this. We end up going 15 for 15. We got all 15 spots. And it's because a bunch of us were knowledgeable. We understood how to up the gas. We understood if we didn't up the gas, how many people were waiting and how much they were paying. Like, we basically had all that analysis going on. But like, some newbie had no chance against us because we knew what we were doing.
Alex, I the fact you're getting offered $270,000, if I or 90 ETH, which is $270,000, I would if I were in the position, and there's a reason I'm not, but I would feel the need to give access to those people to also be a part of the community. I think I would be very tempted to sell, to allow other people to come in.
Here's one thing that I think none of us have mentioned and that I think is really core to Bored Ape is that everyone here is crazy. Like every person who owns a Bored Ape is absolutely bananas, like diamond holding crazy person.
It's just, that's the community mindset, like all in, you know, whatever, diamond hands.
It's like Wall Street Bets, like on steroids to some degree. And like, there's no reason, I spent $800 on my first ape. I bought it for 0.32. There's no reason I should not sell it right now. The floor is like 110. Like there's no reason, but like, listen, I've made enough money from the serums and the mutants and the other and the ape coin that we all got. Like I made enough that like, I don't know, if it goes to zero, like it'll be a fun post on Wall Street Bets, you know? Like at this point, and that's like the mentality. So these people are just absolutely like not rational. And that's what you're dealing with a little bit.
Yeah. Well, at some point, right? Like if you could live your life and what else, past a certain standard of living and ability to do what you want and all of that. And especially if people have gotten rich along the way in a bunch of other derivatives, it's kind of like, hey, why not? Right. And I think we're seeing, at least in the public markets today, we're recording this on a Friday, this the last 2 weeks, I think a lot of people that had this mindset in tech are getting awoken to the change in this. But at the end of the day, right, like, you know, the Tiger guys, Scott Schlieffer still has a $122 million house in Palm Beach, right? I think he's going to be okay. Alex, I realize that's an investor, so God bless him, but I think they're going to sleep okay regardless of playing the long game and all of this stuff, right? So Max, I sense that you're the because you're consumer first and venture first and not Bored Ape first or whatever, crypto degen first, you might have a little more skepticism about like all elements of this game or where it's going from here. Is that a fair characterization?
I don't know if I would describe it as skepticism, but I think it informs a lot how I think about what this ultimately becomes. Like everything that Alex just described, it requires so much expertise and time and like the degenness about yourself, right? And so like that is not a mass market product. Like that you cannot expect, like this is not Fortnite. You cannot just like plop down and play. This requires like a serious commitment to it. Not that different from the, you know, Wall Street Bets. Like I guess you can YOLO, but that's not really playing the game. You like have a strategy and community and kind of like aspect to that. And so I do think that it informs who the target audience is, what is the ultimate product and kind of how does that play. I think I less and less convinced that this is going to be like your general market, your, you know, 50-year-olds are going to be like playing in their free time. Like it is just like a very different vibe and a very different vision in my mind. I might be wrong, and there might be kind of, you know, down market products on coming up that are more approachable, but this financial game, and it is a financial game right now, this is not a, you know, entertainment driven game, this is a financial driven game, is such that it is only speaking to a very particular type of customer who this is for.
I mean, it takes a rare person. We've talked about like Reed Hastings at Netflix, his ability to go from selling DVDs to building the subscription digital product to then with syndicated content to building original content, right? And like most people aren't good. You kind of catch lightning in a bottle once, right? And the ability to up level to other things, I think, you know, Zuckerberg's done pretty well doing that, but taking inspiration from other companies along the way. I think Evan Spiegel's probably done an interesting job of that. But it takes a very unique person, especially in consumer, to be able to not just have a second act, but then also have a third act and have a fourth act, right? And it seems like this community gives a lot more forgiveness around the edges here where they can make mistakes and it's not going to be catastrophic because there are so many people that are dyed in the wool behind this. But the difference between launching a cool, you know, initial NFT versus building this huge game, right? And obviously they have people helping them out that know what they're doing, but those could be very different skill sets.
For sure. And I think it also depends on how you define the community, right? And then, and that's the one where To me, the definition of community is that people who are going to be there no matter how poorly things go. Like, it's kind of like being a Knicks fan, you know, like Alex, like, you're going.
Me too, Alex. We have that. I've had season tickets for the last 7 years or something. So I'm familiar. It's a painful existence. Max, I understand you're a Celtics fan. So I have no sympathy with you right now.
Yeah, no comment. But right, like, but that's community. Like, you're going to be there no matter what. And like, quite frankly, I don't think Yuga had that moment yet because the numbers still go up. All the people who are the vocal members of community, who are vocal members of the ecosystem, like, the number goes up. We all keep making money. The drops keep happening. We keep making more and more money. And so like, that to me is like, we haven't had a true test of community here in my mind, but like, right now we're more like shareholders. Like, shareholders are there when things are going well and we expect them to keep going well.
Yeah, we haven't had the James Dolan years yet of Bored Ape Yacht Club kind of dragging through the last 20 years of mistakes that the Knicks have had.
What do you guys have to do is to make today? Come on.
You and me both, man. Look at me. I've got a Tennessee hat on. My last 20 years have been miserable fandom. So I'm very familiar. I'm really punching at myself here. So that's an interesting analogy and to think about. This really is like, this is a fandom, right? And it's a year old fandom and community and all the elements of it. But Alex, I don't know how you got roped into being a Knicks fan. I grew up in, my dad wasn't one. My dad was, we've been Tennessee fans for 75 years in my family or something. And so that was one that was like actually in my blood. And I, as much as I've tried to kick it, I couldn't. Knicks is a more recent, like last 15 years that I've cared about it. But Tennessee goes back to a region for me, right? And I have all the memories of Peyton Manning and watching it with my dad when I'm like 8 years old or whatever. Like, I have all that. And so that's really dyed in the wool. This is a year old community. And so do you think, like, how many of the people do you think are in this for the financial gain versus this community means so much to them at this point?
Well, so first of all, I've been a Knicks fan my whole life. Grew up in Manhattan. So, you know, 90s Knicks. A lot of great memories, a lot of bad memories too. So my thoughts are, I think there's definitely a lot. I'd like to see, like, if Apes drop to 5 or less or 1, how many people would still be active? I don't know.
Which is again, to do the translation math, but $3,000 versus 30,000 or 5 would be $15,000, right?
Yeah. Like, I'm just wondering what would happen.
What's the floor right now?
Like 110, 106 or something like that. Some big number. But here's my thought process is that, like, they did all these things, you know, just the hits. It's like the dogs, the mutants, the game, the mobile game is super fun. We didn't even talk about that. ApeCoin, the land now. And this was like before, like, any money was like raised properly, like a venture round. The people are like, oh, the good times are over. Like, I think that the rewards are going to be even crazier going forward. I think the things that they're going to be doing to holders and like ApeFest that's coming in New York. And I think it's going to be just like whatever we thought it was, it's going to be over here. So
when is ApeFest, by the way? I don't know do I need to be in New York for this or do I need to get out of New York for this?
Well, you need to have an ape and then you need to be in New York.
Got it. Okay.
But it's at NFT NYC, which is at end of June. But I think that things are going to get crazier. I could be wrong, but that's my rationale. And people ask in the community, like, should I sell? What am I doing? I'm like, listen, if you need the money, you know, get it. But if you don't, like, I think long term, this is what everyone thought the CryptoPunks hold should be. You know, everyone's like the OGs and the whales. That's what apes have become.
Thank you guys for doing this. Any last thoughts? Real quick, we can do a quick round. A year from now, where are we in all this? Like, do we think that is the game launched? Is the community larger than it is? Do you think this will continue to go up? I realize it's hard to speculate, but maybe we can just end there. Alex, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. Yes, community's bigger. I think they launch like mini games as time goes on, like little fun games that don't require. I think they start to give some more clarity and just like bananas activity, just because they start to explain stuff. I think they're gonna drip as time goes on. But I think there's the big game, which is like a AAA game that's gonna take like a year or two. And then I think there's like mini games, because if you actually look at the SDK and what they're asking for, They're looking for skins. They're looking for avatars. They're looking for like people who want to build these things using their SDK. And they're looking for mini games, casual games. So I think there's going to be a lot of different little games before the big one comes.
Got it. Tropo?
Yeah, I agree. There's going to be, as far as other side, something dripping just to keep interest, just to keep hype going, just to keep secondary going, which is really super important. At the same time, I think the BAYC continues to grow its influence. It continues to reward its fans. They just got a shitload of money and they're not afraid to spend it on those people. And I think it's going to be another crazy year.
Max?
I have no idea what's going to happen in the next 10 days, and I have no idea what's going to happen in 10 years. But in between, I feel pretty optimistic because of what Alex described, which is resources, right? They've raised so much money. They raised even more money through these drops. They're going to have probably more drops. There's just a lot of resources to keep building with a team that is oriented towards building. And that is how you ultimately, you know, drive returns and kind of the shareholder interest and therefore more interest and more community members, etc.
Good deal. Well, thanks everyone for joining. This was super fun to do and educational for me. So this was fun. Have a good weekend, everybody.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
So that concludes part one of episode 15 of Three Cartoon Avatars, or episode one of Cartoon Avatars, however you want to score it. We're going to do a separate release of part two, where you'll hear the conversation between Ben Thompson and Packy McCormick and I. So keep an eye out for that as well.